It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You know, every year when the Thanksgiving show rolls around, the same things come to mind. The Thanksgivings we can never forget. You know, the ones that you laugh over each year, the ones that are the dependable icebreakers when the table goes silent. So what am I saying? What I'm saying is we don't treasure the perfection. Now, that's bad news for all of us who are selling it at this time of year, but getting wound around a poll about the perfect turkey or the dream table or the Norman Rockwell family fuzzies, well, that may just be a way of making ourselves miserable. So I say, go for the fun. Nobody gives thanks for anxiety. Stay with us. We're going to be talking Turkey Day and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This episode of The Splendid Table is brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus. Discover the Hyundai Equus, the new premium luxury sedan from Hyundai, offering first-class refinement and features. And take the Insider Survey for this podcast at podcastinsidersurvey.com. That's podcastinsidersurvey.com. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. This week it is choices, choices, choices for the big feast. Well, we're here to help and hopefully to lighten up any pressure. Melissa Clark's got her family's No More Tears stuffing. We've got a Thanksgiving menu for all the Italophiles, and for questions on how to cook the bird this year, to brine or not to brine, to salt, to high heat, to low heat, we've got food scientist Harold McGee with a clutch of possibilities. Then again, you could take a completely different tack.
There's all kinds of holiday food, but I think probably my favorite is turducken.
Oh, I heard of that. Do people actually eat them, or is it just a joke?
Turducken. I can't even say it without smiling. I first heard of turducken a few years back while watching Paula Deen on the Food Network.
I have been so excited now for weeks knowing that I was going to share this recipe with y'all. It's called a turducken. I've got a turkey, a duck, and a chicken.
And then last year, I heard Anderson Cooper give turducken a shout out on CNN.
Then for the people who never met a living thing they didn't want to kill and eat, there's the turducken. The turkey stuffed with a duck that's stuffed with a chicken. Turducken. Get it?
Okay. Turducken is a turkey stuffed with a duck stuffed with like a chicken.
And you know, turducken is one of those things. Out of sight, out of mind. But without fail, each and every holiday season, somehow, somewhere, I'm reminded of turducken and I smile. This year, it happened at my local Whole Foods. While I was waiting to order my holiday turkey, there, on the butcher's case, a bright red sign proudly proclaimed, "Yes, we offer turducken." So I was like, okay, turducken here in Santa Barbara. Let's talk to one of the guys in charge here and get the story.
My name is Jason Simmons, and I'm a member of the meat team at Santa Barbara Whole Foods. Well, the turducken is a chicken stuffed in a duck, which is stuffed in a turkey. The duck and the chicken are both deboned. We open those up, we put stuffing between each layer, and then we wrap them up, and then you tie the turkey up like you sew it, and there you have a turducken. Some people were thrilled that we had them. They were really excited. I'm waiting for feedback on how they turned out.
Okay, so that was interesting, talking to Jason and finding out what was happening here locally with turducken. However, I knew there had to be way more to this story than and what was happening here. So I decided to go to the source and speak with Hebert's Specialty Meats in Maurice, Louisiana. These are the guys that really popularized turducken as we know it today.
Yes, ma'am. It originated here. My name is Eric Duyon. I'm at Hebert's Specialty Meats in Maurice, Louisiana. There was an elderly man that came into the meat market, and he bought his own turkey and duck and chicken in and asked if they'd mind deboning them and stuffing them. We have three different layers. In the first layer, you do a pork stuffing, and the second layer is a pork stuffing, and the third layer is a cornbread dressing. That's the traditional way. But we have people that change the stuffings and do anywhere from shrimp etouffee to crawfish etouffee in them. You bake it in the oven. It takes you 5 hours to cook it at 375, 4 hours covered and 1 hour uncovered. This year is doing good. It's not as great as it was last year, but with the economy the way it is, it's really not that bad at all. I mean, we probably sold 400 to 500 turduckens easily for Thanksgiving, but the big push is for Christmas is when we sell the most of them. I enjoy it. It's real good. It's a novelty item. You cut, let it cool down before you cut it, and you can see all the different layers of meat in the turducken. You can probably feed 25 to 30 people on one easily. It's 16 pounds of solid meat, so it goes far. Remember, Hebert Specialty Meats is the home of the original turducken.
Turducken. I can't even say it without smiling. Go ahead, you try it. Turducken.
Independent producer Diane Bach will be celebrating the holiday and eating turducken along with her family in Santa Barbara. The original Thanksgiving feast was a group of immigrants sharing the harvest with some very helpful native peoples. All immigrants, by the way, are not this lucky. You know, it's rough coming to a place where you don't speak the language, and if you're Asian, for instance, you don't look like everybody else. You're the perpetual stranger. So what do? Well, you hold on to your foods for dear life. And sometimes you do this in some very unexpected places. Chinese food scholar Grace Young follows the Chinese immigrants who took this path in her book, Stir Frying to the Sky's Edge. Grace, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, okay, the story you have to tell is how the Chinese took their woks and stir frying and essentially went all over the world. But what's the most vivid example for you of this story?
Well, one of the most unusual is the Chinese of the Mississippi Delta. They came in the 1870s. They were brought as indentured servants to replace the black slaves in the cotton fields. But that did not work out. And so, in fact, the Chinese ended up running these little general stores all around Mississippi. Every little town had a Chinese family that ran a general store, and most of them didn't have any other Chinese family in the town. So they lived a very isolated existence. They ran these general stores that carried things like molasses and salted pork and the vegetables that the sharecroppers like rutabaga and turnip greens. And during the process of doing the book, I interviewed a number of women who are now in their 70s and 80s who grew up in the Mississippi Delta during the 1930s and 40s, and they told me about what their life was like.
What about the language barrier?
Actually, these women told me that their mothers and fathers in many cases did not know how to speak English. And so the black sharecropper would come into the store and point to an item like the molasses, and their mom and dad would just take it down, and they knew their numbers in English, and that's how they communicated with each other. It's quite extraordinary.
It really is extraordinary. So tell me about these women. What did you learn from them?
So one of the most poignant stories was Rachel Sit Wong, who explained to me that until the 1940s, they had no access to Chinese vegetables. In fact, there was only one market in all of Mississippi, in Greenville, Mississippi. It was called Zhou Gao Nui, that carried Chinese groceries. And most of these families would make a pilgrimage to Greenville just once a year. So whatever they bought just had to last for the year, so they might buy soy sauce or Chinese dried mushrooms or something like that. But she said to me that her mother came from China in 1918, and that longing to taste a Chinese vegetable never left her. And one day, Rachel said, her mother took English pea pods and shelled them, and then she pulled back the inner membrane and stir-fried them with beef and garlic to remind her of the taste of snow peas. And I at first I didn't understand what she was talking about, but there is this very thin inner membrane, and she pulled it back. If you just stir fried it without doing that, it's too chewy.
Yeah,
and
you
fibrous.
Can't eat it. Yeah,
you can't eat it. The other thing Rachel told me is that her mother really missed lotus root, and one day she peeled a potato, thinly sliced it, and stir-fried it with a little beef and garlic. And she cooked it, Rachel said, she stir-fried it just enough so that the potato was cooked but still crunchy to remind her of the crunchy, sweet flavor of lotus root. So they didn't have Chinese ingredients, but they used the technique. The technique is such a chameleon technique that they could adapt it to local ingredients. And they preferred that to actually eating American food.
You know, probably every immigrant group that moves to another place finds these kinds of solutions. But it's especially tough, I think, going to a new country when you don't speak the language.
Right.
And the other thing is that you don't look like everybody else. And how did that in Mississippi, how did that work?
Well, I think that they were so isolated. Apparently, in 1900, there were only 240 Chinese living throughout Mississippi. And the greatest the population got to was about 1,200 in 1960. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine they're living in pure isolation. And the longing for home is so intense, so that food creates that connection, that memory connection that's so important for all of us.
Did these people ever get together?
That's a very interesting question. Apparently, when there are weddings or births or celebrations, they would all get together and they would have these giant feasts outdoors for sometimes 500 people or 1,000 people. Yeah. And 6 or 8 men would cook the meal. They might make a stir fry of shrimp with celery, a fried rice, sometimes bird's nest soup or soy sauce chicken. And they would cook using giant woks that were set on metal drums. And now that I've talked to a number of people from the Mississippi Delta now, Chinese Americans, and they all speak about the fact that everybody knew each other, that all these families in different towns, they had no family connection to each other, but there was this sense of solidarity that whenever there was a major celebration, they all got together. And to this day, they're still going on cruise ship trips together. it's a really beautiful, everybody knows each other. Whenever I talk to somebody and mention Ellen Fong, everybody knows her, or John Chan, or Rachel Sitwong. Uh-huh. It's just like this giant club.
Grace, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Grace Young's latest book is Stir Frying to the Sky's Edge. Now, take a look at what diaspora fusion can become in her recipe, Chinese Trinidadian Stir-Fried Shrimp with Rum. It's up on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're roaming the site, check out our collection of recipes, our podcasts, and sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And for all those listeners using Twitter, use the turkey hashtag to tell us about your upcoming Thanksgiving feast. Stay with us. We're coming back in a moment with Chef Eric Repair and the Cook's Food Scientist Talking Turkey. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. This episode of The Splendid Table is brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus. We're surveying our podcast audience to learn about your favorite wine pairings for holiday dinners, your most loved kitchen appliances, and more. Please go to podcastinsidersurvey.com and tell us what you think, and we'll let you know what other listeners of this podcast said in an upcoming episode. And while you're there, be sure to check on the new 2011 Hyundai Equus, featuring first-class everything, including heated and cooled seats, complete with driver back massage. Discover a new kind of luxury and the special survey for this podcast, all brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus, at podcastinsidersurvey.com. That's podcastinsidersurvey.com. French-born chef Eric Ripert and his New York restaurant Le Bernardin have been riding high for 15 years. No small feat in the competitive and sometimes brutal restaurant world. Then in his spare time, he manages to judge on Top Chef and do his TV series, Avec Eric, which is devoted to traveling and cooking with family and friends. Well, he joins us here today. Eric, it's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today.
You know, I'm thinking about this. You are running for restaurants. You are doing charitable events. You're doing television. You're all over the world. What is your life like now? How do you manage this?
My life is very, actually, simple. I separate my private life from the public life and from the working in a restaurant. So when I am at home, it's just talking about what's going on at home. And then I go to work and I arrive at the restaurant around 10:30, 11. And I spend my entire day and evening at the restaurant. And then I go back home. And it's very simple like that. And of course, I have some traveling to do. So when I'm traveling, I'm very organized as well. And I'm trying to work hard, of course, but try to find some peace some time to time just to be able to be strong all the time.
I went on your blog and I was interested to see that you have quotes on it from the Dalai Lama. And I didn't realize that you're a Buddhist.
Yes, usually I don't talk about it, although it's not a secret. And but I realized that lately the Dalai Lama is tweeting from where he is in India, Dharamsala. And it's very inspiring to me. And I think the message is very universal. Therefore, I retweet his tweet.
But how does Buddhism and what happens in a restaurant kitchen? I mean, a restaurant kitchen is like a pressure cooker. The two seem very far apart.
Not so far, actually. I mean, you know, you can manage your team in a very brutal way, or you can manage your team in a very compassionate way. And a long time ago, I used to manage the Le Bernardin kitchen when I was a young chef, the hard way. And I didn't get very good results. And then I guess through my experience and learning and getting inspired by Buddhism, I changed the way I envisioned Le Bernardin, although when I manage the kitchen or the dining room or the restaurants, I never bring the fact that I am Buddhist and it's inspired by Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. You were raised and came up through the French system.
Yes.
And this,
the hard way.
The hard way.
Education.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, the whole point there was that the apprentice or the chef is the person who is beaten upon verbally and much is demanded.
And physically.
Really?
Yes, of course.
Wow.
You get beat up.
But how do you make that change?
Well, you make that change when you see that it's very simple. When you're losing all your staff, including key people, you sit down and think, what's wrong here? And when you're not even happy yourself about your journey, you, again, take time and reflect and think about what can you do to change and make it better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very logical that you have to do things which are more rewarding for yourself and mostly for others.
Let's talk about Thanksgiving. What's Thanksgiving for you and what kinds of things will you be making this year?
Well, Thanksgiving for me, I mean, you know, I came here on the late side and I was French and I became American later on. However, I learned that it was one of the most celebrated holiday in America and turkey being definitely the centerpiece of the celebration. I'm not a fan of turkey. I find it a little bit dry for my taste.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when it's Thanksgiving, I always do... I always try to find a very, very large chicken and I stuff it. And I use some chicken livers and I use some bread and I put some mushroom in it and sometimes chestnuts and I, you know, cook it slowly and so on. And my celebration is very, very close to what a traditional Thanksgiving will be.
So it's the chicken, and then you've got the sweet potatoes and the whole.
Oh, yes, for sure. Yes, yeah. Well, I do a gratin dauphinois, which is potatoes and, you know, cream and cheese.
Oh, yeah.
It's slightly different, but it's good, too.
And I gather the whole family's gathered around?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. And, you know, part of my family is from Puerto Rico, and they bring also some specialties from Puerto Rico. And we end up eating what they call the pernil, which is basically a ham baked in oven. So it's, you know, it's a great interaction, and it's we spend a great time together.
Well, Eric, thank you, and a very happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Eric Repair is author of Avec Eric, A Culinary Journey with Eric Repair. Now, his grandmother's chicken could easily stand in for that big bird. The recipe, roast chicken with za'atar stuffing, is up on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, I like the idea of that za'atar stuffing. Anything goes, I think. As I suspect it does for Melissa Clark. Melissa writes the New York Times A Good Appetite column, and she's author of In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite. Melissa, good to have you back.
Hi, great to be here.
So I'd like to talk stuffing today.
One of my favorite topics.
Do you see it the way I do, that there's sort of two approaches? There's the traditional bread stuffing, and then there's kind of the 21st century approach to stuffing.
Absolutely. I feel like for a meal as traditional as Thanksgiving is, I see that a lot of people kind of go crazy with the stuffings. Don't you see that? You know, they'll make the same mashed potatoes, but they're going to really go wild when it comes to that turkey stuffing.
Yeah, it's like their freedom dish or their whatever.
Exactly.
So let's track out a traditional bread stuffing.
You know, the most basic stuffing is just something to absorb all those wonderful poultry juices in the middle of the turkey. You know, you're going to lose those otherwise if you don't have something yummy in there to absorb it. And so what do you use for that traditionally? Old bread. You know, little bits and pieces of breads that you can save right before Thanksgiving. Traditionally, you don't need to do much to it. Maybe some seasonings, onions, celery, eggs. A lot of people like to add chestnuts, which is our family's preference. Mushrooms are another very traditional stuffing ingredient. Maybe a little bit of bacon or pork. But you want to keep the seasonings light, because what you really are looking for is the predominance of the bread to absorb those turkey juices are so succulent.
So two elements then, essentially. You've got flavorings, the vegetables and that kind of thing, and you've got the
right.
bread.
Exactly.
Do you always saute your vegetables first?
I always do. They're not going to cook in the stuffing in the middle of the turkey cavity. They're going to retain their crunch. So unless you saute them, you're not going to get that melting, tender quality that you really want out of a good stuffing. You know, my mother has a trick. She starts doing her stuffing, I'd say, about 3 weeks before Thanksgiving. She sautés
three
her
weeks?
Vegetables. I know. She loves to save time. So she sautés her vegetables, her onions, her celery, and she puts them in the freezer. And then, you know, she'll start to save bread. And so she'll take all the ends of the breads and the leftover bagels, and she'll put them in the freezer. And then the day before Thanksgiving, she and my father will peel the chestnuts and roast the chestnuts and chop those in and then make the stuffing proper. So it's a good trick for anybody looking for time saving.
You know, we can tease about her doing it ahead, but that's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
Just a little sidelight. Do you have a trick for getting those chestnuts peeled that you're not going to lose your thumbs?
You know, it's so funny, because you can buy peeled chestnuts, but they just don't have the crunch of a freshly roasted peeled chestnut. It takes a lot of work, but this is the kind of thing that you're doing once a year for your family for Thanksgiving. So I would say, if you can possibly find the time to go ahead and use my dad's trick, take 6 or 8 chestnuts at a time.
Yeah.
Put them in the microwave. You know, first you score them. You always have to score chestnuts. You just want to cut, you know, just use a paring knife, make a little cut into the shell so they don't explode. Definitely don't want that.
No.
A little cut into the chestnut, 6 or 8 at a time in the microwave, just for a minute or two. And it happens very quickly, and then you take them out and you peel them while they're still warm. And the reason you do 6 or 8 at a time is because if you do them all at once, by the time you're done peeling the first 6 or 8, the rest are cold, and it's much easier to peel a chestnut while they're still warm. And I think that works very well. You can do a pound in 10 or 15 minutes.
That's a great idea.
It's a good trick.
I should mention, by the way, if you were to drop one or two of those warm chestnuts into a small glass of cheap red wine, you'd have a great treat. Okay.
Oh, but I've never done that.
It's the Italian thing. I can't.
You think it would work with rum too? Ooh,
oh, I don't see any reason why not. But okay, let's go to this idea of the 21st century stuffing, the free-for-all stuffing. Now, let's say we don't want to use bread, for instance.
Right,
we want
and
to
you
use
don't
vegetables.
Have to use, you can use all vegetables. I have done sweet potato stuffing. So what was absorbing those great juices? Sweet potatoes. And
oh,
I put shrimp.
Good.
Oh, and it was almost like a hash. I sauteed everything on the stove, sweet potatoes, shrimp, celery, onions. I seasoned it aggressively with chili, which I don't usually season stuffing very aggressively, but I wanted this one to have a real personality. And I kept some of it separate because a stuffing like this is a very good dish for someone who doesn't eat turkey, although it did have shrimp, so it's not strictly vegetarian.
Right.
But it was very good for someone who didn't want the turkey because it has its own personality. You can do it with rice is a terrific stuffing, and wild rice especially is very evocative of fall and
right.
Thanksgiving,
yeah.
Which is great. You can also use all meat. This one, this is going to be the Atkins stuffing. But talk about tradition. This dates back to the Renaissance. This is a very old recipe. It's called a farce. And you take ground meat, also very highly seasoned, and you put that in your turkey. And it's not so much absorbing the turkey juices as it's almost like, imagine a giant sausage. And your turkey is your sausage casing. And so it's this whole other thing.
And, does the
and
meat
it's delicious.
Cook through, or is it cooked before it goes in?
You cook it before it goes in for the safest stuffing. You really want to cook it.
But that could be really delicious.
It is. It's a whole other thing. It's something that people don't think when they take that stuffing out of the turkey. They don't think it's going to be ground pork. And believe me, people love it if they eat pork. They really do.
I mean, what could be bad? Hey, Melissa, this sounds great. Thank you.
Oh, this was fun. Thanks, Lynn.
Melissa Clark is author of In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite. Now that recipe, Clark's Family Traditional Chestnut Stuffing, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. This is definitely the time of year for a food scientist who cooks. I mean, that turkey presents so many questions. Cook it hot, cook it low. Wet brine, dry brine. To stuff, not to stuff. Well, we have got food scientist Harold McGee with us today. He joins us with his latest book, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Harold, it is good to have you back.
Great to be back, Lynn.
Okay, let's start with the main event. Everybody wants a beautiful bird. So how do we get that beautiful brown skin?
Well, if you can, you want to start with a bird that has been air chilled or air processed rather than water chilled or water processed. And the reason for that is that part of the standard processing after the bird is plucked is to chill it down either with cold water or cold air. Cold water ends up being absorbed to some extent into the bird, and that's why you'll see on the labels up to 2% added water, something like that. And that's not a terrible thing, but it's not a great thing for getting a brown skin, because what you're trying to do when you get a brown skin is dry it out in order to get the browning reactions going. So if you can start out with less water to begin with, it'll have more time to brown and it'll brown more deeply. So you want to start with an air-chilled bird. Kosher and halal birds, if you have access to them, mm-hmm. are generally air-chilled rather than water-chilled. And then if you can take the bird out of its wrapping and leave it open in the refrigerator to dry the skin out some for a day or two beforehand, that helps a lot. And then when you're ready to cook the bird, it's a good idea to oil the skin. That helps cook the skin faster. It turns out that in the first parts of the roasting process, the skin is actually kind of cooling itself off by releasing what moisture it has. It's kind of like our perspiring on a hot day. And you want to minimize that as much as possible. So if you rub a layer of oil on the surface, that'll help transfer the heat much more rapidly to the skin and get the browning going.
So if you've brined the bird, which means it's been sitting in water and it's absorbing water, that oil will help counteract that?
Yes. It's true, because brining means essentially getting salt water into the bird. That means you're going to have to cook that water out again in order to crisp the skin.
Okay, now let's talk about the heat in the oven. What do you prefer, that slow roast or high heat fast roast?
Well, again, if you want a crisp skin, the best thing is high temperature, because that's going to get the drying and the browning going on the surface much more rapidly. Those two processes basically give you different degrees of control over the cooking. And so if you cook at a relatively low temperature, that means that the bird heats through relatively slowly. That means that you have a bigger window of opportunity to notice that it's done and get it out before it gets overdone. But because it spends more time in the oven, it does tend to be a little drier overall than if you cook it at a very high temperature, in which the cooking is very rapid, spends less time in the oven. The problem with that is because it's heating very quickly, your window of doneness is much shorter, and you have to pay much more attention to the progress of the cooking.
I think I've been working on a premise that is totally incorrect, because I always thought that the slower you cooked a protein, you know, something that has moisture within its cells, meat, that the less those cells shrunk, this is probably bizarre to you as a scientist, but the less those cells shrunk, the less liquid from those cells escaped. So things stayed moister and plumper. And that if you cook them very fast, it would almost be like you were squeezing a sponge and getting all the moisture out of it.
Well, you're absolutely right that the fibers, the muscle fibers, do shrink during cooking, and that that shrinkage is directly related to how much liquid you lose. So that's absolutely correct. The thing is that because the meat spends, say, an extra hour in the oven, mm-hmm. if you're cooking at a low temperature, that means that the outer parts of the meat, which are closer to the oven heat, dry out more than they would if they were in a hotter oven but spent much less time there. So it's a balancing act. One gives you, correctly done, a juicier roast overall, but you have to pay a whole lot more attention. The other one is a little more fail-safe. And in the end, you know, it's maybe not so easy to distinguish the difference in juiciness between the two. You know, if you did a side-by-side comparison, it might be hard to really tell.
Oh, okay. Resting the bird. This is something you always hear about. What's going on when you take that bird out and you let it sit for 20 minutes?
Well, to begin with, the heat evens out, because when you take it out of the oven, the outer parts of the meat are pretty hot, close to the oven temperature. The very center of the breast is much cooler, mm-hmm. maybe 150, 160 degrees if it's still moist. So there's a tremendous temperature differential, and that's something that evens out after you've taken the meat out. If you cut it right away, then the outer parts are going to be much hotter and the inner parts a very different temperature. So the temperatures even out, and also the distribution of the juices evens out, because the outer parts have lost a fair amount of their juice, but the inner parts are releasing some of their juice, and some of that gets distributed back into the drier outer portions. So you end up with an evening out of the juiciness, and it turns out that as the bird cools down, those juices tend to stay in the meat tissue better than if you cut right away. So you'll just end up losing a lot less juice if you let the meat rest and cool down a bit than if you cut it right away.
That's such a gift to the cook. It gives you time. All right, what about the leftovers? Because you get to the end of this kind of meal, you're exhausted. Are there certain things that have to be dealt with very quickly and others that can wait?
Well, you really want to get the leftovers into the fridge as soon as possible. And that's usually the last thing on your mind after
a
wonderful Thanksgiving meal when you've been working all day. You finally get to sit down and relax, and then you eat, and then you have an extra glass of wine afterwards, and you're chatting. But while you're doing that, unfortunately, you have to kind of remember that back in the kitchen, the warm kitchen, the moist kitchen, bacteria are beginning to grow on the surfaces of the leftovers. And so you need to get the leftovers into the fridge as soon as possible in order to minimize the chance that they're going to cause a problem in the days to come.
Harold, thank you. I think you've saved a lot of us from perhaps some unpleasantries. And may you have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Lynn. You too.
Harold McGee's written The Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Well, for this year's splendid table Thanksgiving menu, the turkey is the slow-roasted variety. It's an Italian-American Thanksgiving, and the turkey's permeated with fresh herbs and basted with wine and butter. We've got that Italian wheat, the one that tastes a lot like barley, farro, and that's been tossed with greens and nuts. We've got a red wine gravy, a spicy balsamic syrup over roasted butternut squash, a recipe for pan-braised green beans, and for a big finish, an apple rosemary tart with lemon sugar and a pumpkin pie panna cotta. And it's all on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now the question is, what is the Norman hole, or in French, le trou normand? And yes, it does tie into a Thanksgiving. You start the music. We're going to be back with the answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a few minutes, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook. Give us a call at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. splendidtable.org. But for right now, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the Norman hole, or in French, the true Normand? Well, this is one of my old favorites, and it is a very appropriate thing to know about at this time of year. The Norman hole is from Normandy, France, where dinners are hearty, plentiful, and very long. It is what you do when you know you cannot eat another bite, and you also know that if you do not eat another bite, your host is going to be deeply offended. Well, leave it to those practical French. In Normandy, when they hit the wall, they sit back, take a deep breath, and chug down a tot of local apple brandy. Very young apple brandy. It practically burns its way down. And that is the Norman hole. It sets you up for another round with the dinner plate. File this away for next Thursday.
Are you going on Thanksgiving Day to those family celebrations? Passing on knowledge down through the years at the gathering of generations.
The lines are open. We are ready for your calls. Anything goes. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Check in with us on Facebook or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see who's up. We have got Kelsey calling from Aberdeen, Scotland. Kelsey, hi. Good to hear from you. What do you want to talk about?
Lynn. I am a student at Kalamazoo College, and I'm studying for a semester at the University of Aberdeen. And my boyfriend Alex and I would like to make a Thanksgiving feast for my flatmates who have never had one before.
Ah, yes.
So I'm looking for a couple ideas on preparing turkey and maybe some side dishes in my very, very, very small kitchen.
Okay. Do you have an oven?
Yes.
Okay. And can you get a turkey?
Yes.
All right. No, because I know in some parts of Europe that can be really tricky to find.
Yeah.
Okay. So make sure the turkey is defrosted and defrosted in the refrigerator. Okay.
Okay.
And then what you're going to do is you're going to rinse it. You're going to pat it dry. And the day ahead, you're going to take about 6 or 7 branches of fresh thyme. You're going to take maybe 3 or 4 branches of fresh rosemary, a lot of fresh basil. And if you can't get these things, you could use dry herbs.
Okay.
All right. And you're going to mix that with a bit of butter and garlic. And
that sounds good.
It's just delicious. So what you want to do is just stuff that under the skin of the bird, under
okay.
the breast, under the legs. If you can do the back, it's great. Stick it in the fridge overnight. And then the next day, you put the turkey in a shallow pan.
Mm-hmm.
And first, you're going to put in the pan some big carrots and some stalks of celery and some thick sliced onion. And that's going to be your rack.
Okay.
And it's going to give you great pan juices. You're going to salt and pepper the bird. You can rub it with some butter or olive oil. And then you're going to put it breast down. You're going to have the oven at about 400.
Okay.
And then when it's in the oven about 20 minutes, you'll turn it down to 325. And you'll baste it with some wine. whatever you've got, a dry red, a dry white, white, you know, makes it prettier. But the idea is you want about a half a bottle of wine that you're going to pour over that and then keep basting with those pan juices as the turkey cooks. And you figure,
that sounds so good.
And if you don't stuff it, it's about 13 minutes to the pound. Okay. And the way you know it's done is that you can easily wiggle the leg in its socket and it moves. And if you have a thermometer, an instant reading thermometer, you want the center of the breast to be about, 160, 165.
Okay.
All right. Turn it over the last half hour or so of cooking so the breast browns. And then the real trick here for the turkey is let it sit out on a platter for 20 minutes to a half hour because it finishes cooking, and that's how you're going to get the rest of the stuff together. Now, tell me what vegetables you like and what's available.
There's a lot of sweet potato over here, and I was thinking of just making baked sweet potato, bake it in the oven, and then mash it.
Oh, I think that would be wonderful.
And then there's a lot of broccoli and Brussels sprouts and carrots.
You know what would be wonderful to do is to take the Brussels sprouts and the carrots, cut the carrots into sort of sticks, cut the Brussels sprouts in half. Do you have a big shallow pan that you can use on top of the stove?
Yep, we cook in it all the time.
Okay. So what I would do is if you have some oil, any kind of oils, film the bottom of the pan, put it over high heat, salt and pepper in there, okay?
Okay.
And then throw the Brussels sprouts and the carrots in there and kind of try to brown them, all right? And then add water and whatever herbs you like.
Okay.
Or seasonings. Like, for instance, you could throw in some cinnamon and some allspice, like cinnamon sticks.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
And you could put in some raisins. Toss that around, and you add enough water to cover them by half. Put a lid on it and let it simmer slowly until the vegetables are really tender, and then uncover and boil away all of that liquid so it makes a glaze.
Oh, okay.
And it's delicious, and all of that can be rewarmed.
Oh, yeah, that sounds really easy.
And the other thing is, you know, isn't there great Scottish bacon?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, boy. If you had a couple of hunks of that bacon in that mix.
Oh, that would be great.
Or even with your sweet potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
That would be great. I think you're pretty much home free.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And, you know, anything there that you see that's local and people will feel comfortable having it on the table along with these other things, throw it in. Because people love to have new things, but they also kind of like to feel the comfort of having something they're familiar with.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
You have a great holiday.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay, bye, Kelsey. Call us 800-537-5252 or reach us online, splendidtable.org. Christy is calling from San Francisco. Christy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I am a Southern girl, and I just relocated to the Bay Area, and I also love Thanksgiving. It is my favorite holiday in the world. So what I wanted to do this year, because it's going to be an extra special Thanksgiving, it's not only my first Thanksgiving in California, but it's the first Thanksgiving my boyfriend Bill and I are having together in our shared home, because he's moving out to California with me. I am a lucky girl, and he's going to roll up the day before Thanksgiving in his moving truck. So I want to have a really lovely meal. And I'm looking for ways that I can not only honor sort of my Southern traditions, but to incorporate cool new things from California and San Francisco. And especially, I'm looking for tips on how I might be able to bring Dungeness crab into my meal. We're going to be living by the ocean, and I have taken up crabbing.
Dungeness crab, and you're catching your own?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't stand this. Okay, Christy. First of all, what are some of the traditions from your home that that say Thanksgiving to you?
Well, deviled eggs. We always have deviled eggs in my family.
Right.
And my favorite thing about Thanksgiving is, we called it dressing growing up, but I mean, people probably know it more as stuffing.
Right.
So those, to me, are the things that are most important. Probably for Bill, the turkey is incredibly important, and there will be a turkey. But, I mean, it's just about family and gathering and lots of emphasis on kind of those showpiece items. Then the sides always tended to rotate out.
Okay, so these are the Southern components for you. That dressing, how your family does it, that's got to be on your table. That's what you're bringing to the two of you. And the deviled eggs. You've got to have the deviled eggs.
Right.
For me, you have to have the deviled eggs. I have never gotten enough deviled egg. But a couple of things come to mind with the crab. Number one, making the traditional deviled egg and then taking chunks of that crab, some fresh lemon, a little bit of sharp mustard, a little bit of mayonnaise, a little crunch, maybe from very fine minced onion, and that goes into the egg. And you've got crab stuffed egg. Leave out the yolk. There's no yolk whatsoever.
That sounds wonderful.
Another way you could do the crab is that you make it a complete first course unto itself. You could take a little bit of good mayonnaise and mix into it some capers and a little bit of lemon, chopped parsley. And
okay.
if you wish, the smallest amount of garlic, and you could do that a day ahead, because if it sits overnight, it's great. And then what you can do is take chunks of that crab, put them on a bed of really tart greens, because the crab is sort of sweet, and you have the contrast of the greens, which are tart, and then daub that mayonnaise on, and then just sprinkle that with some chopped green herb. And it could be something simple as parsley, or it could even be coriander. And that is the star of the first course. I mean, you could do both of those things with the crab and really celebrate being there. So that's a couple of ways you can bring the California piece and the piece of your heritage.
Oh, I love these ideas. And just thank you from the both of us for helping us make our day special.
Well, we raise our glasses to you, too. You're starting a new life together, and that's pretty swell.
Lucky girl.
Have a wonderful turkey day.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Oh, I love the idea of starting out with Thanksgiving. Ah, it's just great. For my husband and me, it was Christmas Eve. That was the first holiday we celebrated all by ourselves together. And it became sort of a, you know, you set a new tradition and then that becomes your life. Anyway, enough sentimentality here. We have Melissa calling from Sunland, California. Melissa, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm going to be hosting Thanksgiving for the very first time in my new home, and I basically have no idea what to do with the bird. Now, I've been reading a couple articles suggesting that brining is the way to go.
Right.
I want to know how you feel about brining. And if I do brine the bird, how can I use the giblets, or can I stuff the bird beforehand? I would love to have some insight about brining.
Okay. Brining itself is a great way to ensure a juicy bird. Because essentially what's happening is that the bird is absorbing that salt water and plumping itself. Mm-hmm. So you can do, let's put it this way, you can cook the you-know-what out of the bird and it still stays somewhat moist.
Yeah.
it's very forgiving. The basic formula is a quarter of a cup of kosher salt, all right?
Kosher salt.
Not iodized, because it gives kind of a funny taste. You could use sea salt as well. A quarter of a cup of salt per quart of ice-cold water, and then about a quarter of a cup of brown sugar or white sugar. You can pull back a little bit. The thing is, you don't taste sweet as much as that sugar seems to balance the salt.
Mm, okay.
If you want to add seasoning to it, overdo the seasoning, because otherwise it just disappears.
Okay.
All right, now you have to cover the bird completely, and the bird must be kept stone cold. And you'll probably have to do 3 quarts. So just multiply the recipe. And you brine the turkey. For every pound of turkey, you give it about 45 minutes to an hour. So overnight.
Okay.
And I like to keep it, no matter how big the turkey is, no more than 12 hours, because you don't want a pickled turkey. And then, and what I would do then is I'd make the stuffing separately, and I'd bake it off early or the day before, so that all you have to do on Thanksgiving Day is warm it up. Because one of the ways to cook a brine turkey that's really dynamite is you drain it, pat it dry, you could rub it with oil or butter, and you put it in a 450-degree oven for 10 minutes to the pound. Now, the gravy's going to be salty, the pan juices, but now let's go back to your giblet question. Take the neck and the giblets. I throw in some chicken legs or turkey wings, some celery, carrot, and onion, cover with water and chicken broth, and simmer that. And you can do this a couple of days ahead and make a really intense broth. I always add wine to that broth, but I add wine to everything when it comes to turkey. But what you do is you can simmer that down. You put no salt in it, strain it, get rid of the fat, and then you can pour off most of the fat from the pan juices and let the pan juices be the salt. You see? And pick up some of those pan juices, stir it in to this really intense broth that is, you know, you can almost boil it down till it's almost syrupy. And if you want to thicken it, the way you thicken a gravy is put a tablespoon or a teaspoon of flour, depending on how much you have, okay? Mm-hmm. For every cup, you might want a teaspoon of flour, every cup of liquid, in the bottom of a tall glass, and then keep beating it around with a spoon as you add maybe half a glass at most of cold water. And then you pour that into the boiling liquid, and you let that cook about 4 or 5 minutes until there's no raw flour taste, and it's going to get shiny, and that's your gravy.
Awesome.
Okay?
Okay.
Long-winded, but check out the website because a lot of this is actually in print.
Oh, okay, good. That's good to refer to.
Yeah, and go forth, okay?
Okay.
Take care, Melissa.
All right. You
Bye.
Too.
And that's the show for this week. Remember, you can reach us anytime. Call us 800-537-5252 or join us on Facebook. Every year we get this Thanksgiving show together and we get advice from the very best on how to pull it off with ease and style and maybe even a little grace. And then the holiday comes. And we work and we eat and we work and we eat and we eat some more. And what do we remember and retell in the weeks to come? The trip to the emergency room with the carver of the turkey and his 5 cleanly cut fingers from the new Japanese knife. Or when the deep fat fryer tipped over with the turkey in the midst of an impromptu football game. Or how about the time when the 5 kids roasting marshmallows over the post-dinner fire ran back inside the house with the remains of those marshmallows all over the bottoms of their feet? I'll bet you remember that one. Well, just remember this. Those are lovely memories, and that's what makes a holiday a holiday. Well, I hope your holiday is great. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought. What's the difference between a chicken and a turkey? Chickens celebrate Thanksgiving. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Our show is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. For you listeners tweeting, tell us how your Thanksgiving meal is coming together at splendidtable.org or use the turkey tag on Twitter. And don't miss us on Thanksgiving morning for our annual Turkey Confidential. We're going to have some great guests stopping by, including Jamie Oliver and Jose Andres. That's live 11 to 1 Eastern Time on Thanksgiving Day. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear, Roger Miller, and Julia Schrankler. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a good holiday. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.